It's a story about a city, an imagined city called Omelas. Have you read about that? Omelas is a city of happiness and of civic celebration. It's a place without kings or slaves. They don't have a stock exchange. The atomic bomb hasn't been invented. But what the writer tells us is that lest we find this place too unrealistic to imagine, here's one more fact about it, about this city of happiness. In a basement, under one of the beautiful public buildings of the city, there is a room. The room has a locked door and no window. And in the room sits a child. The child is feeble, malnourished, and neglected. It lives its days in wretched misery. And here I'll read you a passage from the story. They all know it is there, all the people of Omelas. They all know that it has to be there. They all understand that their happiness, the beauty of their city, the tenderness of their friendships, the health of their children, the abundance of their harvest, depend wholly on this child's abominable misery. If the child were brought up into the sunlight out of this terrible place, if it were cleaned and fed and comforted, that would be a good thing. But if it were done in that day and hour, all the prosperity and beauty and delight and happiness of this city would wither and be destroyed. Those are the terms. So here's the question. We have a city of perfect happiness, if you could imagine it. And the only price you have to pay is that there be one child held in the windowless room, neglected, living in misery. Would you do it? How?
I think I would actually probably let the child suffer in order to
promote the overall happiness. You would let the child suffer to promote the overall happiness of the city. All right. And you have a counterexample from wartime. Go ahead.
Yeah, the wartime example. During wartime, for example, if we have to have the victory of this battle, we have to we are now selecting someone to accomplish the mission. I wouldn't arbitrarily single out a person to fight this battle for us. I would actually have a due process, maybe have a lottery. But I mean, this is not against the whole principle of utilitarianism, right?
So you're accepting, by saying that you would live in this city and you would leave the child there, because those are the terms, you're being consistent with, you're being true to Bentham's utilitarian idea.
Yeah.
How many agree? How many agree with the utilitarian idea, even in the case of the city of happiness? How many disagree? How many think the city of happiness is built on an injustice? And why? What do you say?
That if the child is suffering, then those people who let the child suffer, they do not deserve that happiness.
Uh-huh. Wow. All right. So that actually introduces another idea. And what's your name?
Jenny
introduces another idea. First, actually, Jenny slightly shifted, maybe she shifted position in an interesting way. First, she said, that the people in that city aren't really happy if their happiness depends on the suffering of the child. And what I think Jenny meant there was, tell me if I have it right, that justice is indivisible, and even happiness is indivisible. So that if one person is suffering a grave injustice, everyone can't really be happy knowing about it. Even if their GDP is high. And then, when challenged by Howe, Jenny made a somewhat different argument, which is that maybe they are happy in a way, but they don't deserve to be. Now that, in a way, takes us to the third idea of justice. Bring in the idea of deserving to be happy. Now, the utilitarian idea, all that matters, it's interesting, in the utilitarian idea, all that matters is the pleasure people actually feel as a factual, empirical matter. So that if some people derive pleasure from looking at great art in the museum, that pleasure is to be weighed against other people's pleasure who may get pleasure in less exalted ways. Like what? Watching dog fights. Or something like that. Pleasure is pleasure for the utilitarian. And there's no passing judgment, really, on the quality or the worth of the pleasure. But when Jenny says that they don't deserve to be happy, that suggests that justice is a matter of rewarding or answering to what people deserve. That's the virtue idea. So if people are happy, even knowing that someone is suffering, there's something, what you would say, Jenny, missing in their character. Yes? They lack virtue. If they could be happy, knowing that their happiness is at the expense of this suffering. And therefore, the arrangement is unjust because it's not in line with virtue. So in a way, you've taken us, Mindy took us from utilitarianism to Kant, the idea of justice as respecting the freedom of the individual. And Jenny's answer took us from utilitarianism to the virtue or desert-based idea of justice, the Aristotelian idea. That's very interesting. Thanks to all of you for this really terrific round of discussion on these cases. Really very interesting. Well, where does that leave us? In a way, we've only just begun. We started with the utilitarian theory of justice, maximizing welfare. And we saw how it seems to be in tension with the second idea, the Kantian idea, of justice means respecting freedom, the freedom to choose, and justice means respecting persons as ends in themselves, not treating them as means or instruments. And we had a debate between those two, the utilitarian and the Kantian idea. And then just at the end, we had the question of whether people deserve to be happy if their happiness is based on mistreatment of someone else. So these really are the two objections that were raised against the utilitarian idea of Bentham and of Jeremy Bentham, that it doesn't respect individual rights, and that by simply adding up pleasures, it doesn't assess the worth of pleasures. Who deserves to be happy if some child is suffering as a result? Now, John Stuart Mill came along a generation after Bentham, Kant had already raised his objection, and others had raised the virtue objection. So John Stuart Mill tried to save utilitarianism from the rather simple and crude version of just adding up pleasures that Bentham had offered. And so John Stuart Mill said, it is very important to respect individual rights and individual freedom. He was a utilitarian. But he was also one of the great defenders of the idea of liberty. But he said it's all within a utilitarian framework. Respecting liberty will make everyone better off in the long run. Still a utilitarian idea. Kant would not have accepted that case for freedom because it still depends on instrumentalizing people. We should respect their freedom not because they're ends in themselves. We should respect their freedom because in the long run, everyone will be happier if we do. And John Stuart Mill also tried to answer the virtue objection. The objection that said utilitarians can't distinguish between higher and lower pleasures. Did he succeed? Well, he tried to say you can still be a utilitarian. You can still base morality on what people actually happen to want. And if some people like great art and other people like to watch dogfights, we can say that the lover of art has the worthier pleasure. How? You know what is? You know how he answered that? Anyone? How did John Stuart Mill say a utilitarian could take account of differences between the higher and lower pleasures? Anyone? Someone who's experienced both. I don't know how many people actually go to the Yard Museum and go to a dogfight, but if there is someone who's experienced both, then whichever one he or she prefers is the higher value. Now, do you think that is a way of addressing the virtue objection?
No.
You don't think it's convincing? Why not? So it might be, actually, you could do this test for yourself. I mean, if there is anyone here who has experienced higher pleasures and lower pleasures, is there anyone who's experienced both? Probably you have. Isn't it sometimes the case? What would be an example of a lower activity that we nonetheless like? We watch boxing. I don't watch boxing. Do you? Oh, well. Do other people here watch boxing? What would be an example of something that you admit is not worthy, a worthy pleasure, but that you do like? What would be some more? Watching boxing is good. What else? It is possible, by introspection, to try Mill's test, to try to think of something that you recognize as a lower pleasure, but you nonetheless like and sometimes prefer, like that card game, or watching boxing, that you prefer to the higher thing. I actually do this experiment with my class. Did you get that far? Did you see how I try it out? By showing, yeah. All right, they've seen too much of this. Professor Deng, do you know what experiment I use with my students for this? They all do. I show them a clip of Shakespeare, a Shakespeare soliloquy from Hamlet. That's a higher pleasure, right? And then I show them an excerpt from The Simpsons. And I ask which they like more. And they all say The Simpsons. And then I ask which is the higher pleasure. And most say Shakespeare, but some say The Simpsons. But here's a test of John Stuart Mill's idea of, and it doesn't seem very persuasive because we do sometimes, those of us who've experienced both, actually prefer the lower thing. Now, we can still judge the higher thing as higher, but that seems to require something other than just what we most like. Which means, if that's true, that to make qualitative judgments about higher pleasures or what's worthy of making us happy, we have to step outside the utilitarian idea of just working with pleasures and pains. So it's not so clear that even John Stuart Mill succeeded in rescuing utilitarianism from Kant's objection about freedom and respect for persons, or from the Aristotelian idea that justice has something to do with what pleasures are worthy. Well, we've already covered a lot, and I want to hear what the commentators have to say. I'll just end with one story, but I'm afraid some of you have heard this story too. The story that proves the difficulty of translating all virtues into utilitarian terms. The true story that I remember back from the days when I was a graduate student in Oxford. You want to hear that story, or do you all know it? I was a graduate student at Oxford in England in the 1970s. And back then, they had separate colleges for men and for women. The women's colleges had rules against male guests staying overnight. These rules were rarely enforced and easily violated. Or so I was told. Pressure grew to relax these rules to let men stay overnight at the women's colleges. And it became a subject of debate at St. Anne's College, which was one of the all-women's colleges. Some of the older women on the faculty were traditionalists. They opposed allowing male guests on conventional moral grounds. They had a certain idea of protecting the virtue of their young women. But times had changed, and the traditionalists were embarrassed to give the real grounds for their objection. So instead of talking about virtue, they translated their arguments into utilitarian terms. They said if men stay overnight, the costs to the college will increase. How would they increase? Well, they said they'll want to take baths, and that will use up hot water. Furthermore, they argued, we'll have to replace the mattresses more often. The reformers said, okay, we'll meet those arguments by adopting a compromise. Each woman can have a maximum of 3 overnight guests each week, provided each guest pays 50 pence a night to defray the cost to the college. This is a true story. The next day, the headline in The Guardian read, St. Anne's girls, 50 pence a night. Which goes to show that the language of virtue does not translate very well into the language of utility. And soon thereafter, they got rid of those rules altogether and abolished the fee.